Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Research into the causes and cures of all types of diabetes is constantly advancing. New studies show cannabis use may actually lower blood sugar and stave off obesity that causes diabetes. A recent study in the University of Chicago School of Medicine suggests there may be a single gene responsible for the adult onset diabetes 25.8 million Americans have. That's 8.3% of the population have diabetes. An estimated 79 million more have prediabetes, and we all know someone who's affected by the disease. Endocrinologist Dr. Matthew Larnum joins us today to respond to your questions and comments. He comes to us from Albany Medical Center, where he serves as director of the Division of Endocrinology and Metabolism. He earned his medical degree from Wake Forest University and completed his residency at Greenwich Hospital in Greenwich, Greenwich, Connecticut. He's a specialist in endocrine disorders, including diabetes, thyroid disease, pituitary disease, adrenal disease, osteoporosis, and treating transgender patients. Dr. Larnum, thanks for being here, my friend, to be part of today's conversation. All of you, other friends, give us a call at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Let's talk to you now, and you can, of course, email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about, I want to talk about one of those subspecialties, that's osteoporosis. Do we know why so many people have it?
Well, people are living longer nowadays, and so that's part of the problem. We tend to lose bone mass as we get older. Now, whether you want to call aging normal or not, that is what happens. So as we live longer, all of us, if we live long enough, will get osteoporotic bones.
Now, there was some study I saw long ago and around the hill that said that when you took the anti-reflux drugs, which many of us do, the Prilosec and all the others, that that might have an adverse effect on your bone health. Do you know about this?
Yeah, there's an association of the use of those anti-reflux drugs and decreased bone density. Association, we're not positive that it's cause and effect. It could be, and there are some mechanisms that have been implicated as potentially being causative. My recommendation to people is that most of the reflux medicines that we use are not meant to be taken for your entire life. It's supposed to be used to treat specific episodes of gastritis, reflux, whatever. But the problem is people get on these medications, feel fine, and then say, oh, I'm just going to keep taking it. And all of a sudden, they've been on it for 5 or 10 years.
Well, it's not that easy, coming from a guy who's been on it for maybe 30 years. So by the time it was all said and done, they say every once in a while, yeah, well, why don't you try to wean yourself off? And then there's hell. If you happen to have, hiatal hernia, and, you know, you're getting this stuff, then you get a choice between osteoporosis. I mean, I know this is a little glib, and, you know, cancer of one of the upper respiratory parts, I don't know. But those are tough choices, aren't they?
Well, yes. There's always some potential drawback to any kind of medication or something that you're doing. There's no such thing as a perfect drug that is only going to treat exactly what you need and never be associated with any kind of potential adverse outcomes.
Right. 1-800-348-2551. We want to hear from you, as we are about to hear from Phyllis. Hey, Phyllis, you're on.
Interesting that my question so closely follows up with the doctor's last comments, because I want to know not how safe, but why some of the newer diabetic drugs have such awful side effects that make them really fearful to take, and then within a year or two they're taken off the market because they're fatal. I find it very frightening. Can he comment on that, or on some of the drugs that he feels might be safer?
Any drug that comes out, when it gets approved by the FDA, it has gone through testing in generally thousands of people over the period of months to a few years. The problem becomes when you put a medication out to the general public, now you're talking about potentially millions of people.
Then you find out.
For much longer periods of time. And yes, that's sometimes when you find out some of the side effects, or side effects that in the study that was put for the FDA, they didn't even necessarily know to look for a certain side effect. It develops later on. So there always should be a little bit of caution when a new drug is approved. Yes, it gets approved because we think it's safe, but you're never going to know for certain that, in fact, it is absolutely safe or absolutely safe in all people. So, yes, there's been some diabetes drugs that had come out. I'm thinking of Resulin and in the class of what's called the TZDs or thiazolidinediones that came out and turned out to be associated with liver problems. Now, it was rare, but the problem was the liver didn't recover when you stopped the drug. So that drug got pulled off the market.
Now, you does your practice, you have quite a few doctors in your practice at the medical center, which is, after all, a research institution. Do you ever test these drugs?
We are involved in some clinical trials, yes.
Yes.
So these would be studies that are set up by the pharmaceutical companies to test the drugs. And usually what they're testing, of course, is efficacy. Part of what they are expected to test as well is safety. So, yes, we have participated and are currently participating in some clinical trials.
But there are some safe diabetic drugs. I mean, I know a lot of people, for example, on metformin, the drug, that seems to be safe.
In general, the longer a drug has been out, the more experience we have with it and the more we can say whether we think it is safe or not. Metformin has been out 20 years in this country, 25 years in this country, and an additional 5, 10 years over in Europe. And
what, do we test the Europeans first before we take the drugs?
We could.
I've
we
actually,
don't.
I've actually heard that one before, Phyllis, and I'm glad you caught it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, some drugs come out in Europe before they come out over here. Metformin was one of them.
What is that?
The process for drug approval over there is a little bit different, and the potential market. Remember, when a company's bringing a drug to market, they're only going to do it if they think they can make money. And so the situation in Europe and the United States, while it's similar, is not exactly the same. So there are occasionally drugs that the drug makers say, it's not going to pay for me to bring it out in Europe, or it's going to be too expensive for me to initially bring it out in the States. Let's see how it does in Europe, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I once had a doctor tell me, I think somewhat humorously, but maybe not so humorously, that the way that drugs were tested were first on the animals, second on the Europeans, and third on us. There's nothing to that, I'm sure, right?
Well, no, there's a seed of a joke in there because it does get tested on animals first. And what's happening now, it's very expensive to do clinical trials in this country because there are enormous regulations in place to be certain that every patient is followed very carefully, everything is done, all your T's are crossed, I's are dotted, et cetera. Mm. So it's expensive to do trials in this country. So there are, in fact, some drugs that do get tested in cheaper environments before they get rolled out or tested here. Now, it is required that testing occur in the United States for the FDA to approve a drug in the United States. They will not take only trials outside.
Interesting. I'm sorry, Phyllis. Go ahead.
No, and the financial rewards to the drug companies are more than enormous. They're gigantic. And how much can you trust the not the accuracy, but the honesty of the drug companies?
Well, you're opening up a can of worms here. Obviously, the profit motive is enormous, and without the profit motive, we wouldn't necessarily have development of so many drugs which are useful. But you do bring up a point that you have to be careful. Now, the clinical trials themselves are conducted at various centers and offices around the country, and there's no shenanigans going on in those places that's, you know, driven by anyone in particular.
Although, if I could just say, there's been a recent thing in which at least one drug company has announced that they're not going to be, quote, paying for speeches by the doctors, which some people thought was sort of bribery.
Oh, yes, and that's a whole other topic. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, you know, when we contract with a company to do a clinical trial, they can't come to us and say, we want to see this result, we want to see that result. We're independent from that.
Yeah,
and we're running the trial, sometimes not even knowing who's getting the drug and who isn't and who's getting the placebo. So all that data is there. What happens to it subsequent to that is where things can get a little sticky because, you know, the FDA and the companies, the FDA is limited in terms of what they can release because when a company goes to the FDA with their data, that is still proprietary data.
Interesting.
And I, as an independent person, cannot simply go to the FDA and say, I want to see those actual trial results. I actually want to see the raw data from that trial. No, it still is proprietary by the company.
Shouldn't that be changed?
Well, in an ideal world, but then the drug companies will tell you, then we have no recourse, because if it's out as general knowledge, all this proprietary information, someone else will simply make the drug we're making, and we put all the effort and research into it.
God forbid. Okay, hey, Phyllis, thanks for the great call. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Alan. Yeah. Thank you, Doctor.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Listen, folks, I need you to call. It's your show. It's Vox Pop. And there's somebody out there with a good question that they want to ask. So be right with us, 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Furniture Options, Goshen. Specializing in the stressless functional reclining chair engineered for head, lumbar, and body weight support. FernOps.com. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs, hosting an open house Thursday, February 27th, 6 p.m. St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, Adelphi.edu. St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery. Choose stmarys.com. And Marriott Town Place Suites, Albany Downtown, offering studio, one- and two-bedroom suites with fully equipped kitchens. Amenities include indoor pool, breakfast, local transportation, Wi-Fi, and parking. tpsalbany.com for reservations.
And we are here. Here comes and the phones are ringing, but here comes something at the email at voxpop@wmc.org, who says, I am a 63-year-old woman diagnosed approximately 7 years ago with hypoglycemia. I eat healthily and have generally been able to keep my blood sugar within normal limits. I am followed closely by my endocrinologist, and my A1C has always been good. My youngest sister was diagnosed at age 11 with type 1 diabetes. My father and another sister developed type 1 diabetes in their early 50s. My maternal grandfather died in 1929 from diabetes. What are my chances of remaining diabetes-free, and any precautions you might suggest? Thank you. And this is from Marjorie from Earlton. Okay, what do you think?
The family members that were diagnosed, I think they were diagnosed, she said, with type 1 diabetes?
Type 1... sister at age 11, type 1 diabetes in their early 50s. Yeah, father and
mother. Well, it's interesting because in terms of genetics, there's a stronger predisposition for type 2, which is what we...
Interesting.
What we used to call the adult onset. We think of this as the... This is what 90% of the people have, type 2. We're thinking of the older, overweight,
so-called
heavy person.
Juvenile diabetes.
That's type 1.
Yeah.
And type 1 really is an autoimmune destruction of the... pancreas, and so you're not making enough insulin. And that certainly runs in families and has a genetic, some genetic markers for it. But in terms of primary family relatives getting the disease, it's a much higher hit rate with type 2 diabetes.
And if you look at the one, you're going to probably get it early, right?
Think about identical twins, right? In theory, have the same gene pool when they start out. Close to 50 to 80, 90%. If one gets type 2, the other one gets it. Whereas with type 1, the number is much lower.
Interesting. Interesting, because I'm a twin. That's exactly what happened. Okay, let's go to John in Queensbury. John in Queensbury, you're on.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I have a question for the doctor.
Yep, he's here.
Yes, I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes a couple years back, as my parents had it as well. I was introduced to Dr. Hyman's the blood sugar solution. I know the doctor is familiar with it. So I started taking his diet recommendations, and I'm actually pulled over to the side road in my car right now, so I don't have all my numbers with it. But basically, every time I go back, I in essence don't have diabetes. My numbers are all perfect. Feel great. Lost a lot of weight. Don't eat processed food. Drink a lot of water, and I feel great. I just wondered what the doctor thought about that diet.
Well, I'm glad you feel great, and I'm glad things are going well. I don't think I know this diet specifically.
Yeah, he's been on here. Yeah.
There's been stuff about, you know, the caveman diet, the processed food diets, a whole bunch of other diets. The general bottom line is, as long as you're eating healthy and maintaining a healthy lifestyle, that's the best thing that you can do.
So what should you not do? Should you not eat on the way home at the West Stockbridge store? Should I not buy a chocolate chip cookie?
In moderation.
Aristotle. But so there are those of us who are not immoderate, who are, you know, that we're not moderate.
Well, that's correct. I mean, if you look at the rates of obesity and diabetes, they're both have skyrocketed. And now it's happening in the emerging first world countries like China and India.
Yeah.
For the same reason, all of a sudden the diet is becoming plentiful, fast foods, calorie dense, overly processed, not healthy food.
Yeah. Look at me. I'm not overweight, right?
Heavens no.
So, you know, and I work out every day and all the rest of it, and I probably follow much of Dr. Hyman's, thing. But, you know, my blood sugar runs 110, 105, something like that. It's not great, not bad, right?
That's pretty good.
120.
It's not completely normal, but it's certainly not bad at all.
Yeah.
As we get older, as everyone gets older, they develop a little bit of glucose intolerance. Again, it's a part of aging, as I said about osteoporosis and losing bone. Yeah. If you want to call aging normal, then it's normal. If you want to call aging abnormal, then yes, then everyone developing some glucose intolerance and some decrease in bone density is abnormal as we get older.
Are you allowed to drink coffee, John, from Queensbury?
Not for the first 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, moderately. I love coffee, but I drink it moderately compared to the way I used to.
Well, congratulations on your success, John. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much,
appreciate
Doc.
It. Yep, bye-bye. Let's go to Bill in Ravenna. Bill in Ravenna, you're on.
Hello, guys. I kind of got my question answered already by the previous caller, but I'm a 54-year-old male, and I'm in fairly good health. And I was just wondering what I can do to make sure that I don't have to deal with getting diabetes.
Well, I'll say it again, and it's pretty much, if you think about it, it almost sounds like common sense advice. Eat a healthy diet. Try to stay near your ideal body weight. Stay physically active. I mean, think about how we evolved. We evolved as hunter-gatherers. We spent most of the day either trying to accumulate or find food and deal with those day-to-day things. Now what do? We sit around on our butts in front of computers, watching TV. Even if we're at work, a lot of times we're sitting on our butts. This is not how our bodies were meant to behave. And then when we do eat, we go eat some incredibly calorie-dense or high processed sugar meal, and that isn't what was out there. That's not how we evolved.
Right. Well, of course, we are living till 80 years old now, and we weren't back in the day.
Oh, but actually, that's not completely true. But if you look at, they talk about median survival, and they say, okay, 10,000 years ago, it wasn't as high. Because there were high rates of infant mortality. But if you look at the skeletons of people that lived in that hunter-gathering society, they were healthier than the people when the Industrial Revolution came along.
Well, how old were they?
Oh, they lived into the eighth decades.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
There were plenty of skeletons that had been around, you could tell, had been because of development of osteoarthritis and things like that they had lived well into their seventh, eighth, ninth decades.
I know one guy who reportedly lived till 2000.
Oh, and he had one heck of a sense of humor.
Hey, Bill, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And by the way, is there a correlation between weight and diabetes? In other words, if you get fat, are you more likely to get diabetes?
You're absolutely more likely to get it, but it is not a guarantee. There are, in fact, people that are overweight that do not develop diabetes.
1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent to perfect. We'll go to Marianne from Ulster Park. Okay, Marianne, you're on.
Hi, doctor. I have a question. I'm reading from a book that I have, Grain Brain, and what the book is saying is that there's been an astonishing 48% increased risk of diabetes among women taking statin medication. Is that so?
Yeah, there is an association of statin use. These are the drugs we use for cholesterol. Right.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, your Lipitor, your Zocor, your Crestor, all those are statin drugs. There is an association of increased risk of developing diabetes in people that take those medications. The rate is not 48%. If you look at the big trials that are out there, the rate compared to placebo was definitely higher, but not numbers quite that high. Despite that, the overall outcomes in terms of heart attacks, death, major events, still favored statin use. So in other words,
you're better off taking statins.
Well, so yeah, I mean, if you're talking about mortality, cardiovascular risk, and so forth. Now, that being said, as I said earlier, there's no such thing as a medicine that is completely free of any potential side effects. What I'd love to be able to do is figure out, all right, if you're going to tell me half people in the world are going to die of heart disease, all right, and you can decrease their rates of events by these medications, what about the other 50%? You're certainly not doing them any good by giving them a statin, and maybe that's some of the people who might have an increased risk of developing diabetes on it. And have
just to be clear, though, are women more at risk than men, whatever percentage it is?
Yeah, I think there is some data that states that. I can't recall that off the top of my head.
Okay.
But what I would say is, if you are at risk for cardiovascular disease, I think you're still way better off taking the statin as it stands right now in 2014.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marianne. Appreciate it.
Yep. And we'll go to Mike in Monroe. That's alliteration. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay.
I got a kidney transplant at Albany Medical in 1997, and since then I've been taking Medrol as part of my immunotherapy. And it's made me diabetic, but it's also been like ravaging my circulatory system. My veins are getting smaller. And every time I bang my leg on something, it turns into like a wound care incident because, you know, my legs don't heal that well. And I'm wondering, is there anything I can do about the circulatory system?
You bring up a couple of interesting things. There's actually a form of diabetes that now has its own name, the form that occurs after transplant. It's called NODAT, new onset diabetes after transplant. And it's related in large part to the medications that are used. Medrol is one of them. It's an immunosuppressant. But even some of the non-Medrol regimens to prevent rejection are, in fact, associated with increased risk of diabetes and development of diabetes.
Okay. I'm on Medrol and I'm on Rapamune.
Right. You can talk to your kidney doctor, who I assume is the person still managing the regimen. Because generally after about 5 to 10 years out, if the kidney's still functioning, the transplant surgeons, I don't want to say they're not involved, but they step back a little bit.
I'm almost 16 years out.
Right. So typically over at Albany Med, after about 5 or 10 years, the number of visits with the transplant team per se anymore drops way back, and the kidney doctors are in taking over again. You can always check, because the prednisone itself does a number of things. Yes, it helps you preserve that kidney, but it actually weakens the skin.
And now, prednisone is a steroid, right?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, again, these are just side effects.
It decreases muscle tone.
It decreases muscle tone. It's bad for your bones. It weakens the skin, so it makes the bruising and everything more likely. And the best that we can do in a situation like this is try playing around with the immune suppressant regimen. And so you can try talking to your doctor again and say, hey, you know, can we try playing around with it a little bit? Because look what's happening. I'm getting all these problems with the thinning of the skin, et cetera. But that really is about the best, because if we don't continue with those regimens, that kidney isn't going to work anymore, and it's dialysis.
Obviously,
again.
We don't want that.
Right.
Okay. Well,
thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Again, your chances of getting in are untypically excellent. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Anna from Middleburg, you're on.
Hello?
Hello, Anna.
Hi. My question is about high fructose corn syrup and diabetes and obesity. Uh-huh. And specifically, I was thinking about, I think it was a 2010 study that came out of Princeton about how these rats were fed corn syrup and versus sugar, and they did not, I think they didn't produce leptin, the satiety factor. And I just wonder what your opinion is about the high fructose corn syrup.
Okay, excellent questions. Fructose is a sugar, as is glucose. Glucose is the form in which our cells use, that's the form that they use. So when we're getting sugars, We break them down into frequently glucose, but also fructose. But glucose is what the machinery in the cells is able to use. So fructose and glucose are very, very similar, and they're somewhat interconvertible, but not 100%. And so if you look at certain biochemical pathways, it's not completely clear if, in fact, fructose is exactly the same as glucose. So when you're talking about high fructose corn syrup and the diets that we have, which is a heavily processed diet, there's a lot of associations with high fructose consumption and obesity and with diabetes and so forth. But again, association is not necessarily cause and effect. Where I stand on this, because you can get a whole lot of opinions, no one knows for certain, my view on this is a little bit of fructose is fine, because in fact it's naturally found in certain fruits. But I think if you start eating a diet that's heavily consisting of this processed high fructose corn syrup, I don't think that's a good idea. I think you're probably better off being careful about the amount of fructose in that form that you ingest.
Yeah. Now, while we're on the subject, throwing you a total curveball, diet sodas. There's more and more information coming out that they don't actually help your diet and that they actually excite your sugar needs. I wondered whether you've been following that at all.
Yes, I've been looking at that. What we don't have right now is any kind of definitive studies. Again, these are all association studies.
So yeah, in other
people
words,
drinking a lot of diet sodas.
Yeah, we have
in
a
fact,
couple of them here.
Yes, there's some evidence that perhaps they don't take in the regular sugar soda, but then they're compensating by eating some other forms of sugar as well. So
you mean because they're on the diabetes?
Yeah.
They're on the...
Yeah,
on
and the, so the theory is, well, maybe their brain is getting fooled, thinking that they're not getting the sugar and that therefore it drives them to be hungry and eat other forms of simple sugars, simple carbohydrates.
Yeah.
Again, these are very interesting observations and theories, and we just don't know enough yet. I would say whatever you're drinking, whether it's diet sodas or something, everything in moderation. So, you know, you can always drink water.
Yeah, I was just going to say water is terrific, isn't it?
So I'm not saying don't drink any. No one's going to say, oh, you said don't drink diet soda. No, of course not. And my patients with diabetes, I'd much rather them drink diet soda than sugared soda.
Because
the amount of calories you can get in, you know, a can of Coke, it's going to cost you half an hour to an hour on the treadmill.
Well, I know a lot of people who are on that stuff, on that sauce. I was on it for a long time myself. And they don't lose weight on it. I can tell you that right now.
Well, some people do. I've had some people that have drinking a lot of soda, went to diet, and, yeah, they came down in their weight.
Interesting.
So it's unclear.
Anna, good call. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much.
Right. Okay, we'll go to Ron in Colony. Okay, Ron, you're on.
Hello, Alan.
Hey.
And your guest.
Yeah.
Hello.
I wouldn't want anyone drinking that diet soda that has aspartame in it and a bunch of other chemicals. That's really like a chemical drink, but that's besides the point. That comment about Dr. David Perlmutter in his book.
I don't remember that. No, there was a talk about Dr. Hyman.
Yeah, he's good, too. I like him.
Well.
But Dr. Perlmutter is the one that lady called up about the grain brain.
Oh, okay.
He's got a couple books. Yeah. And he advises, and I agree with him 100%, that get rid of all the grains. And he cures Dr. Gabriel Cousins. I don't know if you've heard of him. In Arizona, has a clinic, the Tree of Life Clinic. If you go out there for 2 weeks, most likely he'll cure diabetes in 2 weeks. And I think Dr. Joel Fuhrman. He has a book on it, too.
Okay, but hey Ron, as much as I respect the call, we don't really know. I mean, you're telling us that he cures everybody and all the rest
of
it.
Well, they do.
Well, okay, well, good. Okay,
type
so,
2.
Okay, so what do you got?
Yeah, so I just want to make a comment. But here's a question for the doctor. When people, you know, I get a kick when people say, oh, I eat a good diet. Well, when people tell me that, I'll say, well, what do you eat? And it's never a good diet. It's like they don't understand, really, you want light food. You know, all this other stuff, if you've got diabetes or pre-diabetes, you want to get your diet right down to, you know, good fruits and vegetables, no disaccharides. And I just want to know, say someone says that to you, what do you actually give them a diet, which Dr. Joel Fuhrman does?
Yes, what we do is we have an RDCDE, which is a registered dietitian, also certified diabetes educator in our office.
Okay, good.
And we sit down and
Dr. Hyman? Sorry, I missed the beginning of the program.
No. Dr. Hyman.
Oh, okay.
Somebody called up about Dr. Hyman.
Yeah, because you're right. When people say, oh, I eat fine or I don't
eat much
or whatever.
They're never eating a good diet.
You really don't
never.
Know. So you have to dig down and find out.
And then, of course, there's a whole question of the great debate as to what is a good diet.
Foods, Alan. Right foods. You want foods with enzymes in it? If you're not taking enzymes every day, anybody, as you get older especially, you have an finite amount of enzymes. Your body is not going to digest foods. You need to take a probiotic minimum enzymes. I'd say like medicinal mushrooms. There are things that you really need.
Ron, unfortunately, we are up against a hard break right now.
Hey, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you for
it's
calling.
Always a pleasure. Yeah, thanks for the program.
Okay. And we'll be right back.
Support comes from Middletown Medical, now offering evening walk-in urgent care for children every weeknight until 9, plus evening sports physicals, 845-342-4774. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs, hosting an open house Thursday, February 27th, 6 p.m. St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, adelphi.edu. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany. Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Dine-in, takeout, delivery, 518-432-0358. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to protect ecologically important lands and waters of the Adirondacks for nature and people. nature.org/Adirondacks. And Nathan Litauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York. Now presenting their Renaissance robotic system for minimally invasive spine surgeries with Dr. Ja'an Shen, NLH.org.
Okay, we're back. We're coming around the mountain. And we are here with a wonderful diabetes doctor, Dr. Matthew Larnum. And he's from the Albany Medical Center, and we are delighted that you're here. A lot of people on the phone. Let's go to Peter in Great Barrington. Peter, you're on.
Hi, I had a question for the doctor.
Okay.
I was curious. I had recently diagnosed myself as diabetic because I had been in the emergency room for a chest pain incident, and they had flagged my blood sugars late at night at about 150, and my doctor really didn't follow up on anything. And as I started having vision problems and other things, diabetes runs in my family, so I started self-testing and saw a friend who was a diabetic and used their meter and was testing at about 254.
When? Okay. After when you woke up?
That was afternoon after a meal. I had been fasting all day thinking my primary doctor would get the original hospital report with the high blood sugars was in late May. And in September, as I was having vision problems and other incidents, I started thinking, well, maybe this is diabetes. And so I diagnosed myself and went in, and they insisted that I wasn't diabetic till they tested me. And then 2 days later, they tested me and called me up and said, you are diabetic. And so that was I had been fasting thinking that I would need to have a fasting blood sugar, but I couldn't get into the doctor on that day. So I went to see a friend, and they said, well, just have lunch. You don't need to fast. We'll test you with a meter. And so that was just after having a moderate lunch without eating anything for the previous night, and I was up to about 254.
Okay.
So as I've been looking around trying to see what's happening, because I know my father appeared to have had heart failure as a result of his doctor when he was ill. He had 5 bypasses, and they kept him on metformin, and he developed heart failure, which seems to have been related to the metformin. And his doctor was completely unaware at the time of those possible complications, and I had seen that on the warning labels after he had got sick. So I was a little weary about taking medications, knowing, because I know, like you say, a lot of this is genetic, and if you have certain predispositions in your bloodline, and I already know what's happened with my family.
Hey, Peter, yes. There's 5 people behind you, so just ask the question. Go ahead.
So my question was, they've done an extensive study in the United Kingdom with a doctor who puts people on a severely restricted calorie diet. It's probably around 600 to 800 calories for a period of 6 to 8 weeks, and everybody seems to have remarkable progress. It's been written up in some of the overseas and diabetes journals, and I was curious if you were familiar with that study and those results, or if that's it was just an immediate way to get the diabetes under control and everybody tests normal. I was just curious.
Okay.
They say it's not a long-term solution.
Okay, got it.
So,
go ahead.
Very restricted calorie diets acutely will drop blood sugars. There's no question about that. And it'll also get rid of something called glucose toxicity. And you don't even need weeks and weeks for that. We can demonstrate that in sometimes as little as a few days. The problem is that, you know, when you throw a monkey wrench like that in a system, no one can maintain those kinds of diets long term because they're not healthy. You're going to starve away. And as you go back to a more regular diet, even in terms of calorie consumption, then that process starts over again where, in fact, the blood sugars begin to go up. You develop a little of that glucose toxicity, et cetera. So, yeah, it's a way to throw a monkey wrench into things, but it doesn't turn out to be a
long-term
solution.
Yeah, it's always the question of what happens when you come back.
Exactly.
Well, that was it, because the long-term results of the people who had been off it after they've been off the diet years later still maintain diabetic-free numbers, and they just went back to eating a healthier, moderate diet. They were no longer on the severe restrictions, and I was just curious if that was something to possibly try to look at.
Well, it all boils down to lifestyle change. We're trying to get people to diet. We're trying to get the people to lose their weight. When we're successful doing that, yeah, a lot of times we see the same thing.
Peter, great call. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Right. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Megan in New Paltz. Megan.
Hi, Megan. How are you?
Oh, sorry, Megan.
That's okay.
Uh-oh. Megan's gone. One more round. Okay, she'll call back, I hope. Let's go to Stephanie in Albany. Stephanie.
Hi, good afternoon. Quick question. About a year ago, I started to feel this dizzy feeling within my body, not on the outside, but on the inside. So my doctor drew some blood sugars, which were normal, but she also did an A1C level. At that point, my A1C level was 6.8. Now with diet change, I've brought it down to 5.8. I guess my question is, where should your A1C be? So not to worry about, eventually getting diabetes.
A normal A1C is generally around 5.5, somewhere in that ballpark. The goal that we shoot for, when people already have diabetes and we're striving for treatment, we try to shoot for around 7%, less if we can get there without a lot of difficulty. You did a very good job getting from 6.8 down to 5.8. That's a big difference, and that's very good. But you have demonstrated by having had that 6.8 that, in fact, you are at risk and always will be at risk for developing diabetes. Now, if you can keep your A1C less than 6, the chances that you're going to develop some of the affiliated complications is next to zero. It's not going to be zero, but it's pretty
so
good.
In terms of Stephanie's question,
as long as she stays less than 6, I'd be,
less
as
than
her
six
physician,
is good.
I'd be really happy.
And
yeah.
What's really bad? Anything over 7 or 7 or 6.5 or what?
Well, let me put it to you this way. We had someone in the hospital the other day that was 18%.
Wow.
18.
But whoa. That's why they were in the hospital.
Yeah.
And the other thing was that I was quite surprised was that I'm thin to begin with. I'm not overweight. I'm, even probably a little under my body weight. So
right.
I was quite surprised that, they had come back to say that my A1C, was elevated with the possibility of, becoming diabetic.
Right.
Let's just make one thing clear. A1C is the test they give you for how your blood sugar has been over 4 months, right? Is that what it is?
Actually, about 3 months.
3 months.
2 to 3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
You can look at it this way, too. If you were not at a good weight, you'd already have diabetes and be taking medicines and so forth. So that's another way to look at it.
Okay, so it's also important to keep the weight down.
Yes.
You bet. Bye, Stephanie.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's go to Nancy in Tivoli. Okay, Nancy.
Yes, thank you for taking the call. Doctor, you're an endocrinologist,
correct.
Right? So I just wanted to be sure. We've heard so much about diabetes. I have an adrenal tumor, and I think it's called an adenoma. It was found to be benign, or believed to be. And your program reminded me, because I haven't had it checked for size. At the time it was discovered, for about 2 or 3 years it was checked to see that it didn't grow. And I'd forgotten all about it till I heard this program, and it must be about 8 years since I've had it measured.
Okay.
Do you think it's necessary, or is it one of those things I can just forget about?
No, I think it should be checked from time to time. Adrenal glands, like a bunch of glands in the body, can develop lumps. We call them nodules. The medical term often is adenoma. There can be other things that is called as well. But in the adrenal, we get concerned because, first of all, it could be a cancer. I don't think yours is, because they said it was an adenoma. That's benign. Or it could be making hormones, because the adrenal makes a series of hormones. And if it makes hormones, it can cause a clinical syndrome. Obviously, this was 8 years ago or so. 10 years ago, it was diagnosed, and you appear to be doing fine. So this would be what we call a non-functioning adrenal adenoma. The recommendation is to follow those with size quantifications in the first couple of years, maybe every 6 months or so. Subsequent to that, it's a little less clear how long we should keep following it. But if it's been 8 years, it might be worth having a look-see.
Okay, that's good, because I have had cancer, so that's there. And that tumor or whatever it is, adenoma, is implanted right in the inside of the adrenal gland. So maybe I will get it checked.
Okay, Nancy,
thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay,
bye.
Right, let's go to Maria in Ballston Lake. Maria, you're on.
Hi. I'm wondering, I have not actually been diagnosed with hypoglycemia, but I did notice when I was about 20, and I'm like 54 now, is that I didn't tolerate sugar very well. I would get shaky after sodas, any kind of, you know, concentrated sugar that didn't have fat or protein with it. So I just sort of avoided it rather than getting it checked out. I mean, but I do have a sweet tooth, so I push it as much as I can with the fatty sweets. My question is, if I am actually hypoglycemic, does that raise my risk of developing type 2 diabetes?
No, and this is actually a more complicated question than you might realize. Years ago, we thought people that had symptoms such as you're describing routinely, we call that hypoglycemia. We've spent a fair amount of time looking into this over the last few decades and found out that, in fact, very few people have true hypoglycemia, meaning the blood sugars are low enough to cause symptoms. Symptoms go away when you raise the blood sugar and so forth. So what is it that people have? Well, we now call it simply a postprandial syndrome. Seems to be related to gut neuropeptides that are released. And yes, there are certainly certain kinds of meals and certain people that may release those neuropeptides and cause those symptoms.
And a peptide is what?
A neuropeptide just means it's a protein type
chemical
transmitter. Okay. So what we tell people these days is take a functional approach to it. If you eat a certain food and it gives you those symptoms, don't eat that food, or don't eat it
don't
in
scratch.
That way.
Don't
or
scratch.
Eat it with, yeah. So treat it functionally, and if you find certain things in the diet you can tolerate, then it means that you're doing fine.
Okay, but if you have low blood sugar, the question, I think, from Maria is...
Yeah, well,
is
the true causes of low blood sugar are not associated with diabetes per se. There's tumors that make insulin extremely rare, or severely ill people with liver problems and other severe illnesses can be susceptible to hypoglycemia.
Uh-huh. And I knew a guy who worked here, as a matter of fact, who used to bring an orange with him because he would get very low blood sugar and he'd eat the orange when that happened.
Well, see, I'm not sure that that was true hypoglycemia. What he found
he definitely had diabetes.
Okay, well, that's different, because then most of the time we see hypoglycemia with diabetes is because of our treatment. We didn't match the insulin correctly. We took one of the drugs too much, didn't eat a meal when we should have eaten a meal, things like that.
Now, there have been, Dr. Garrity's been here a number of times. We have a whole bunch of new things. When I was a young man, you know, in my 20s, people were dying from diabetes in a way that, you know, people are living normal, functional lives right now. This has been an amazing story, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We've come a long way in our ability to appropriately administer insulin. In other words, administer it in a physiologic way, the way that the pancreas would be doing it if you didn't have type 1 diabetes.
So you got pumps and things of that kind.
Absolutely. We have pumps, we have sensors, the technology on these things. It's not a cure, but it has come a long way enabling us for people to absolutely lead normal lives.
See what you started, Maria. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate
it. This is very interesting. Could I just...
Sure, go ahead. Real quick.
So what you think I have is postprandial syndrome?
And prandial in this case
means...
Yeah,
prandial just means eating.
You ate.
Oh.
Yeah.
that's funny.
It sounded more insidious.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly don't have anything bad. You had this 30 years ago, and you're still doing fine.
I know. I was able to manage it. I think I did it functionally. But the symptoms, you know, they were clammy, hot, shaky.
Right.
That would all go with it.
Right. They are similar symptoms that people with diabetes who get hypoglycemia have. But they're also nonspecific symptoms.
Okay, Maria, you got to go.
Thanks
a lot.
So much.
Bye. And we'll go to Joe in South Hadley. Joe, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I remember a couple of years ago reading this big super article about this new research they had done with spleen cells that had turned into insulin-producing cells, and they were talking about how a cure was on the horizon. And then I heard nothing about it ever since then. And I was just curious if you knew anything about that or about any other promising cure research that might be going on right now.
Yes, there's a lot of promising research going on. Of course, what happens is the newspaper picks these things up, and then they don't pan out, but the newspaper doesn't have a headline story that, you know, something they followed a year ago didn't pan out.
We see it all the time.
But there are stem cell projects underway trying to make stem cells, turn them into insulin-producing cells. There's ways to try to make mechanical cells that then you can protect from immune attack and implant them. Oh, there's a lot of things going on, and yes, this has all been right around the corner for the last 25 years I've been doing this.
Right around the corner.
Right around the corner. Still right around the corner.
I remember reading something, oh goodness, I'm going to forget it all, about monkeys who had had vasectomies and something that, had greater incidence of heart attacks. I saw this story, and I thought it was real interesting. And then I never heard another word about it. It sounded kind of interesting.
Yes, well, you'd have to go back and ask the monkeys how they're doing.
Joe, anything else on this?
So anyway, there is a lot of exciting research, and these things will, in the future, I just can't say when, yield additional therapies and treatments.
So the best advice until then is just keep the blood sugars where they should be and keep waiting?
Absolutely.
All right, will do.
Hey, Joe, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay,
yep.
So that's the last call we have, which gives me an opportunity, Mark, Matt, to ask you the following question, and that is, if you were summing up for everybody what to do right now in terms of our current state of knowledge, stay thin, right, as much as you can.
Yes.
And to eat natural foods and not processed foods?
Well, I mean, some foods have to be processed, but I'd say the non-overprocessed food. Don't go in and buy the meal already made up. If you can, buy the fresh vegetables, make the meal. You don't have to avoid meat or anything like that, but you want to have a nice mix, no more than about 50% in carbohydrate, and use complex carbohydrates,
right?
Not processed carbohydrates. Use whole grains instead of white bread and so forth. Simple things like that, I think, making your diet more reasonable. And stay physically active. And this doesn't mean become an Olympic athlete. No.
Walk an hour a day?
Don't drive around the parking lot half an hour looking for a spot that's only 10 feet away from the door at the mall.
Sure.
Park out and walk in. Climbing the stairs. Don't take the elevator. Simple things like that.
But if you had us doing whatever you wanted us to do, would you have us walking for an hour every day?
Yeah, walking is excellent. Walking is very good exercise.
Yeah, it's good for the bones, right?
Yes, because it's weight-bearing on the bones, so it's skeletal loading exercise.
How about bike riding for an hour a day?
Bike riding is good cardiovascular, but you're not skeletal loading.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Same thing with swimming.
And that's the problem with
In terms of osteoporosis.
And also living in the Northeast, right?
Yeah, well, you're not out there making vitamin D, and certainly in weather like this.
Is there a correlation between vitamin D and diabetes?
Interestingly enough, yes.
Boy, I take 5,000 units of vitamin D every day, and you've just made my day.
What we don't know is if that's going to prevent diabetes or help, but there clearly is an association, low vitamin D with both type 1 and association with type 2 diabetes.
Well, listen, thank you so much for this incredible help that you've given us today, and I really appreciate it, Matt. We're just about out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in and apologize to those left on the line. I'd also like to thank Dr. Matthew Leinig, who is from the Albany Medical Center, for joining us today. Underwriting support for the Vox Pop comes from Toprosin, developed to provide relief from those living in pain associated with neuropathy and fibromyalgia. Toprosin, voxpop.com. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop, everybody. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell, and a wonderful job she did. Tom Jobe handled our social media. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.